closest thing that Ami and Andrew have had to a mother lately is Brian, with Joy being gone. And so, you know, I come home one day, and there's my 8-year-old, my 5-year-old sitting on the couch, and they were doing something. I don't even remember what it was now. They wouldn't normally be allowed to do that. And I assumed they had probably gotten permission from Brian, but I just thought I would, you know, razz them a little bit. And I said, looks like I'm going to have to give you two a couple of spankings. And, you know, Andrew looks a little concerned. I said, well, how about if I give both spankings to Ami? And Andrew says, yeah, that'd be fine. I said, well, what if I had two candy bars? Would you want me to give both of those to Ami? And he said, no, I would want one of those candy bars. And so Ami said, well, if I get two spankings, then I should get two candy bars. And Andrew didn't miss a beat. He said, well, I'll take 4 spankings. So it just goes to show that the human mind, no matter how young, can perceive the inner workings of logic to some extent. There is a logic to that if you think about it. But then on the other hand, you say, well, is it really logical? Is there some absolute connection between getting a spanking and getting a candy bar? Maybe there's other ways we can get candy bars. But I feel that way somewhat about what we'll be talking about this morning. If you want to be turning to Hebrews chapter 5, we have been going through the book of Hebrews, and you remember last week we noted that really at the end of chapter 4, verses 14 through 16, are something of the front bookend to the whole book. And when we get to chapter 10, verses 19 through 25, that's the backside of that bookend. And those two paragraphs really summarize the role of Christ as this high priest who has offered a perfect sacrifice. And that really frames the bulk of the body of the book from chapter 5 through chapter 10, in which, in chapters 5 through 7, the writer is going to develop this idea of Jesus as the high priest. And in chapters 8 through 10, he's going to develop the idea of the perfect sacrifice and offering that Jesus is able to make on our behalf. And we saw that kind of signaled in verse 14 of chapter 4. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. Let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace to find help in time of need. And we will find the Hebrew writer returning to that same theme in chapter 10. Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, because we have this great priest who provides such access for us. Let us hold fast to our confession of hope. And that's really what it comes down to in practical terms. Can we hold on to that which is rooted in the very nature and character of God, truth and reality as God has created it and revealed it to us? And where we have failed to hold fast and have fallen short, we have sinned, can we draw near to God and find His mercy and His help? Well, all of that is contingent upon whether we have a high priest and whether we have a sacrifice that can provide that kind of access to God. We noted last week that there are really a lot of ways in which relating to this whole business of priesthood is foreign to us. We don't grow up in a priestly culture, unlike those of the ancient world. Every culture had a priesthood. And they understood the imagery of that. You're separated from God. You have no access to God. Somebody has to bridge that gap between you and God, and that's the role of the priest. But of course, the Bible points out to us, no man can really bridge that gap. The gap between us and God is not simply that God is an infinite being, we are finite beings. That God knows everything and we don't. The ultimate gap that separates us from God is that we are sinners. We have violated not just the commands that God has given to us, but we are an absolute insult to the very character and person of God. You think about this. If, you know, Joy comes back Tuesday night, and I say, oh, honey, nice to see you. I get in the car, I drive off, and I never see her again. I never write. I never explain where I am. I just abandon the family. How would you characterize my behavior? He broke some law. Well, no, it's not even against the law. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't physically harm anybody. I didn't slap her around before I left. There's all kinds of things I could say to rationalize that what I did was really not that bad. But it is one of the most evil things a person can do. Because sin is not the violation of some instruction, some requirement, some commandment. It is the betrayal of a relationship. And that's why if you had met Peter after he betrayed the Lord that third time and he went out and was weeping bitterly, he said, "Well, Peter, what's the problem? Oh, I broke one of God's laws." That's not what Peter was thinking. The full weight of his sin, of how he had betrayed Jesus, was what he was thinking about. This is the chasm that separates us from God. And how will it be bridged? No human being could do that. Because any human being that tries to bridge that gap, he's got his own gap he cannot bridge. Every human being beset by his own sin. So how do you get around that? And that's one of the things that the Hebrew writer addresses in this particular text. He's hinted at some of these things, even in the first chapter, in the second chapter, and at the end of the fourth chapter. But now as he begins developing this idea of Jesus as the high priest, he does so here in chapter 5 by first pointing out some similarities between Jesus and the priesthood that these people understood from the Old Covenant, the priesthood of Aaron that God had established as a kind of a model that points to Christ in the Old Testament. But then when we get to chapter 7, we will see there are some radical differences between the priesthood of Jesus and that of Aaron. And so looking here in chapter 5, the first 10 verses, the text goes on to say, "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. And because of it, he's obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so also for himself. Now, no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. And so also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.'" That's a quotation, of course, from Psalm 2, and that's one that the Hebrew writer has already emphasized in the book. "Just as he also says in another passage, 'You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.'" There's another psalm, Psalm 110, that also has been used by the writer already. And he says the same one that said, "You're my son, I have begotten you, I have raised you up as a king." And that's really what Psalm 2 is about. It's rooted in the Davidic promise of 2 Samuel chapter 7, that the seed of David, "I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me." You are this son, this Davidic son, this Messiah, this king who reigns upon his throne. Well, Psalm 110 is also about the king who reigns on his throne. But suddenly we find Psalm 110 talking about how also this king on his throne is also a priest. And that seems to be at least one of the connections between Melchizedek and Jesus, that Melchizedek was a king. He was king of the city of Jerusalem. He was a king of righteousness. That is, in fact, what his name means. Melchi is the Hebrew word king. Zedek, righteousness, king of righteousness. And so he's a king, but he's also a priest. Now, I think there's a lot of other significant connections. The writer doesn't really develop these until we get to chapter 7, because, as he will say in verse 11, "Concerning this Melchizedek, I've got a lot to say, but it's hard for me to explain to you people because you're not really on the same page." And so he rebukes them and then gets back to the point that he wants to make as he resumes in chapter 7. But here, at least, it has been introduced to us. And his argument, you'll remember, that he's been making in verses 4 and 5 is nobody just says, "Well, I've been looking in the paper. I can't find a job. I tell you what, I'll just be a priest." If you're going to be a priest, you have to be appointed a priest by God, because it's a divine work. And so God has to appoint you. Well, Jesus was appointed as such a priest. In fact, we find that appointment in Psalm 110. God has declared with an oath, "You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek." But then notice verses 7 and following. "In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his godliness. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Well, it's obvious that some of this is really the Hebrew writer just explaining to us what Psalm 110 is saying. And he's going to do more of that when he gets to chapter 7. But here we want to focus on simply what the Hebrew writer says about what qualifications it takes to be a priest. Now, some of these might seem rather obvious. First of all, you've got to be a human being. There's really nothing extraordinary about that. Throughout the history of human beings, people have not appointed, cats to be their intercessors, or it's always human beings. That's who always the priests are. Now, you make deities out of animals, but not priests. And so it's one of your own kind. And there's always something special about him. That's what qualifies him to speak on your behalf and provide you this access to God. He somehow, through magic or something, is going to be able to bridge this gulf between you and God. Well, of course, the old covenant system of priesthood, God had established in order to develop the symbolism that, yes, sin is a problem, it needs to be dealt with, and figuratively it is dealt with through the priesthood of Aaron, but in fact it is not. And only a perfect sacrifice and a perfect high priest could accomplish such a thing. And when we get to chapter 7, we'll see the Hebrew writer developing those significant differences. But here the point is the similarity. You first of all got to be a human being. And so that raises, of course, the question, well, or at least answers partly the question, why did Jesus need to be a human being? Well, if he's going to be qualified as a priest, all priests are human beings, you got to be a human being. You have to be that man that stands between God and fellow man in order to make that access possible. Secondly, you have to be appointed by God. It's his work. He determines the conditions by which people approach him. It's not something that man comes up with and says, well, here's how we think we're going to fix this problem. It is God who has to take the initiative and God who directs it, and so he needs to be appointed by God. And then finally, he needs to be sympathetic. And he's able to be sympathetic because he has the same weaknesses as the others do. Now, weakness doesn't necessarily mean sin. Jesus certainly shared in our weakness. He shared in our temptations. He shared in the various afflictions and adversities of what it is to live in human existence in a physical body, suffering hunger and deprivation and things like that. But of course, with all other human beings, there was also the weakness of sin that enters the picture. And the Hebrew writer acknowledges that one of the first items of business that the high priest had to do was to offer a sin offering for himself, so that he then was ritually pure in order to offer a sacrifice on behalf of the nation. But when you think about how Jesus is the only one that could be perfectly qualified in these three particulars the Hebrew writers mentioned, there's a sense in which you can look at that and it's just kind of superficial. You say, yeah, Jesus was human, he was appointed by God, he was sympathetic to us, that's great. But as you begin to think a little bit more deeply about what these things mean, what does it mean, for example, to be a human being? See, to us that's no big deal. Pretty good to be a human being. I've enjoyed it quite nicely. The past several years I've tried it, and it's great. I plan to continue. I'm not going to go out and kill myself this afternoon and end it all. I enjoy being a human being. And so it's difficult for us to imagine what it would be like for God to leave behind the glory of eternity, of infinity, of all that heaven represents, and come down and become a human being. Now, I don't know what you consider the lowest life form on the earth, whether it's maggots or cockroaches or snakes or rats or whatever. Everybody's got their favorite disgusting critter. You know, how would you feel if someone came up and gave you the offer? Hey, you can become a cockroach. How would you like that? And you'd be like, well, what would the point be? That's disgusting. Jesus comes down, becomes one of us. And we say, well, but man is made in the image of God. Well, that's true. But at the same time, the image of God has been marred by sin, and this world's nothing but a cesspool spiritually. And Jesus comes down and comes into all of this with us without contaminating himself. What it meant for Jesus to become a human being was a great sacrifice. It was a humiliation. And it was a painful experience. And of course, Jesus didn't simply come to be a human being. And when he showed up, he turned out to be, you know, Alexander the Great and living in luxury and wielding all power through the earth. He comes as a poor person, a person of no reputation, really nothing by any standard of this world. And so when we see that it says he became a human being, there's a whole lot more to it than just, well, he was a human. He had to be a human being. And that's what we saw again back in chapter 2. He had to be made like his brethren in every respect, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest to make propitiation for the sins of the people. And he was just like us. With one exception, he did not sin. He was tempted like we are, and yet he did not sin. And so he's able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. He is a high priest who sympathizes with our weakness. Because in that humanity, he was experiencing what we go through. He experiences the fullness of human existence. And what that tells us, of course, is that sin is not an essential part of being human. It's not a necessary part. When God created us as humans in the beginning, we were not created sinners. That wasn't an essential part to being human. And so, in fact, our slogan we like to use, to err is human, to forgive divine, is really not correct. To err is not an essential attribute of humanity. And so you could actually argue that there's only been one true human being that's ever walked the face of the planet, and that's Jesus. The rest of us have been kind of quasi-human beings, partly human beings, only partly doing what our Creator has made us to do. Jesus is the one who's been fully human in all of what it means to be a human being, and therefore is able to be the one human above all others who can intercede for us on our behalf with God. We also read how he's appointed by God. But what does this appointment entail? Is it simply the proclamation God says, okay, you're a priest? No, there's more to it than that. There is this qualification period. In fact, that's what really verses 7 and through 10 are about. He went through this trial period of suffering, of adversity, of difficulty, a life of loud crying and tears, living under the pain of death. And that causes us to focus, yeah, when we went back and said, yeah, he's a human being, the whole point of that, he's a human being who's going to suffer a human death. The frailty of the physical body, and it will be exterminated. That's ultimately the end, the goal of this human experience of Jesus. And it is the final step of the appointment process. You know, at what point is it that God said, you are now my son, I have begotten you. You have been coronated king over your kingdom. It was in the resurrection. It is when he takes his seat at the right hand of God, sets upon his throne as king and priest, that he does become our intercessor and our priest. And what qualified him to do that? How was that appointment completed? Well, this was a necessary part of the process. Now, again, logically, I understand it. That if there's some way it makes sense that if I'm a human being and I'm subject to this fear of death and I'm part of this slavery because of my ignorance and my fear of death and my own sin, that it would make sense that one would come in the form of a human being and redeem me from all of that. He would bear the penalty of sin. He would bear the brunt of death. He would dispel the ignorance. But there's another sense in which it doesn't make sense to me. I don't know why exactly it had to be that way. If you were to ask me, no, explain to me precisely why it was necessary for Jesus to do all these things. Well, I can tell you what the Hebrew writer says, but I can't tell you what he didn't tell me. And that is the deeper rationale and what's going on behind the scenes. I ultimately don't know. And thankfully, I don't need to know. And I think far too often we spend our time worrying about what God's up to rather than what we're up to. And if we were really convicted of our sin and understood what the consequence of sin was, I'm separated from God, I'm spiritually dead, there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. And then when God comes along and says, well, there's something I can do about it, and I have made it possible for you to be forgiven of your sins, where I will consider you innocent, even though in fact you are guilty. And I say, well, wait a minute, God, now I just don't understand that. You're going to have to explain that to me first. Nobody would argue. They'd say, well, thank you, God. I don't understand it, but thank you that you have provided such a way for me. But one thing that we can understand about all this is what was required. This is what was necessary. He had to be made like us in our human form, in his human experience, including death. And so what it meant for him to be appointed by God is pain, crucifixion. And not just the moment of crucifixion at the end, but his whole life he was being crucified. His whole life he's being ridiculed, he's being put down, he's being tormented by the very experience of being a human being. And so when we read an expression like appointed by God, our natural inclination is puff your chest out. I've been appointed by God. Well, not this appointment. You've been appointed to die. You've been appointed to suffer. You've been appointed to an excruciating end, humiliation and shame. That's what you've been appointed to. That's what is entailed in Jesus being qualified to be this high priest. And so when it says he is able to be sympathetic, he knows what we have been through. We talked about this last week at the end of chapter 4. We need to really appreciate the fullness of what Jesus has done to be the one, the only one, that can bridge that chasm that separates us from God. And this is what it took. The days of his flesh, the days of his human existence, the days of his pain, the days of his suffering, the days of his agonizing death. And in that, he offered up prayers and supplications. You know, we know about the prayers of Jesus, don't we? How often the life of Jesus and his praying is described to us, especially in the Gospel of Luke. But the Hebrew writer characterizes these prayers particularly as offered up in loud cries and tears. And we know a few of those prayers as well. You think probably most readily of the Garden of Gethsemane. If it is possible, let this cup pass. But in the final analysis, not what I want, but what you want be done. Or as he's on the cross, suffering the physical torture and pain, well, heaped on top of that, the ridicule. Oh, he saved others, but he can't save himself. Oh, let him come down from the cross now. We'll believe him. We'll worship him. That anguished cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? I think what the Hebrew writer says here summarizes really again the whole life of Jesus. But when we particularly see all of that anguish and suffering focused at the very end of his life, the experience of his passion, the agony of the garden, the crucifixion, to realize Jesus went through all of that specifically to be qualified to be my high priest, that should at least give us some little bit more gratitude for what he has done and how we respond to the offer of salvation that Jesus gives to us. But the other puzzling thing about this whole process is he's praying to the one who's able to save him from death. And that is exactly what he was praying for in the Garden of Gethsemane. Let this cup pass. And we've studied this passage before, that in the context of the Old Testament, that cup can be nothing other than the death itself. That if there's some way that the cross can be avoided, that's what Jesus yearns for. He longs for life as any right-thinking person would, but on a deeper level, he wants to do what the Lord wants. And that is that he died. The Lord is able to save him from death. But then it says he was heard because of his piety, his godliness. And yet, the first thing we would think of when we think of the prayer of the Garden of Gethsemane is, well, God didn't hear his prayer. Clearly, the Hebrew writer is not saying here that God has good ears and he, you know, heard the sounds of Jesus talking, but God said, "Nah, I'm not going to do that. I reject your petition, Jesus." That's not the Hebrew writer's point. The Hebrew writer's point is God responded favorably to the prayer of Jesus. But we say, how's that possible? He died. Because God's answer to his prayer was to save him from death, which in fact is a fulfillment of numerous prophecies throughout the Old Testament, like Psalm 16. And clearly in the original context, David and the other psalmists are praying that God spare them from death. But how that prayer becomes fulfilled in the case of Jesus is not to spare him the experience of death, but rather after experiencing death, he is resurrected. In fact, you could argue it's the best way to take care of death. Don't avoid death, but take it head on and destroy it. Defeat it. If Jesus had simply avoided death, what good would that have done us? Maybe it'd give us an example about how we can cry in loud crying and tears to God and ask him to spare us dying. But what Jesus has done, he's broken the power of death, so we no longer need to fear death. Be in slavery to death. But that now has been removed. And so again, the argument of chapter 2 is being alluded to here in chapter 5, that this has all been accomplished for us in Jesus. And so, although he was a son, and that was the point of Psalm 2, he's the king, he's the son of God, he is the Messiah, he is the one who rules over God's kingdom, that did not exempt him from obedience. It did not exempt him from being as an obedient son to the will, the authority of his father. And he learned that through what he suffered, and that is what made him perfect. Now, again, if someone wants to read that word perfect and say, does that mean Jesus was not perfect before? As if that means that he was in some way a failure, that he was in some there was something defective, there was some sin in his life. That's not the point. Here the word is focusing on the idea of being qualified. Jesus was not qualified before going through this experience of suffering and ultimately death. It is this experience, Jesus learning, not just in an intellectual sense, but in the experience of going through it, what it means to be a human being and to go through what we have done, and in that, to be qualified now as a high priest. And so, you could ask the question, before Jesus did any of that, could he have been our high priest? No. Would he be qualified? No. Would he be the perfect high priest? No. Couldn't be a high priest at all. But now, having been completely qualified to be our high priest, because he has participated in the human experience, he has experienced human death, he has defeated death, all of that has brought it about, made it possible that he is the author of our salvation. And so he became to all who obey him the source of eternal salvation. And so what is the point of all of this that the Hebrew writer has said? Well, the point is really just twofold. Number one, you need to appreciate more fully what Jesus has done. You know, often we want to study the life of Jesus. Look at all the miracles he did. Look at all the crowds following him, and all of his great popularity and reputation. And there's probably a part of me, as I read those stories when I was younger, kind of fantasized, maybe even the fuse of Jesus, you know, doing all these great deeds. This is not the story of Jesus the Hebrew writer says we need to focus on. The story is how these same great crowds crucified him. The story is how his great reputation was based upon a great misunderstanding. They thought he had come to get an army together and deliver them all from Roman oppression. And when they found out that was not the case, they were all too eager to kill him. And you know what it is like, you know, like a girl who's been jilted by her lover. You know, what would have been just apathy before now becomes extreme hatred. And their bitterness and resentment of Jesus is expressed in their desire to humiliate him and crucify him. The days of his flesh, the days of his suffering, the loud crying and the tears, this is the life of Jesus the Hebrew writer says we need to remember. And the second point we need to remember is that he has become the source of salvation to all who obey him. That he has opened up a way of access to God for us. He has bridged the gulf that separates us from God. But that's all. He doesn't carry us across that bridge against our will. He doesn't get a catapult and fling us across the gulf. He's made the access possible, but whether or not we use that access, whether we will follow him and obey him, that's the open question for us today. Will we follow Jesus? Will we walk in his footsteps? Will we pattern our life after the life of Jesus? But if we do, what will it mean for us to be human? Is God calling us to a life of ease in our human existence, or will it also be a life of difficulty, of sacrifice, of suffering? Have we also been appointed by God to a task and a duty that is not so easy? Will we be sympathetic to the difficulties and the weaknesses of others? I'm convinced the thing that will motivate us more than anything else to take the gospel to other people is that we remember what it is to be a sinner. We remember what it is to know the despair of being separated from God and being absolutely hopeless.